It is Tuesday, November 16th. Good morning, Menace Nation. Welcome to Menace in Morning. I am here with my co-host, Chris Drew. Chris, what's going on this Tuesday morning?
Oh, living the dream. I had a tough time waking up this morning, but we're here. Got the crust on my eyes, ready to talk some football.
Gotta love it, man. Gotta love it. 5:30 a.m. wake up call. Chris was like, he wakes up at 4:30 and goes to work, and he texted me early, and I texted right back. He was like, "Oh damn, he's up. I didn't know you were up this early."
I said, "Okay, double take." Whenever that phone buzzes, I think it's an emergency. But it was right, like, "Oh shit, it's
somebody died." I was telling Chris, it's hard to get back into your routine. Like I woke up at 5:15 every day for like my entire life since I got into coaching. And then you get out of coaching, and it's like, especially when you work for yourself, you're your own boss. It's like, damn, I need to get up at 5:15 to get my day going, especially when you have kids and you know, you have a ton of shit going on with mm-hmm. them and family and all that stuff. Like you got to get up early when everyone's asleep to knock some stuff out. And so to have the self-discipline to do that is really hard. And I'm a very disciplined person, but I've never had to be self-disciplined to that point. Like it's always been like, well, I need to be at work by 7. So I better get up at 5:15. So I get in there a little bit early. Like didn't take a ton of self-discipline. It's just what you had to do. Right.
Right. Just part of the process.
Yeah. And when it's something that you like, you don't have to do it. You should do it. You want to do it, but you don't have to do it. That's a whole nother world. But I did want to start off the show and announce something. I'm really, really fired up about it. Been working on this for a while. Everyone knows the charitable stuff that we are doing over here. We've done squares. And if you haven't checked it out, so we did a Buckeye board, a squares, right? Where you pay $100, you get a square, and then there's numbers, the last digit of the winning score, last digit of the losing score, and you can win big money. And obviously, it's a fundraiser and a fun way to legally gamble, and you can have fun and do it, right? The Buckeyes board raised $5,000 for charity, and we've paid out, well, what, we had 2 games left, so whatever that is, we will pay out $5,000 in winning money. And we just launched our postseason board, and I'm really excited about this one because for a number of reasons. One, so the board, you get your square, the numbers come out, and then it is in, that number plays in all 5 of the Power 5 conference championship games, and then it also will play in all 3 of the college football playoff games. So you get 8 games. And I think what I'm most excited about it is if you just hit one, winner, even if it's a first quarter or third quarter, you get your money back. If you hit a halftime score, you get $125. So you make $25. And if you hit a final score, you win $300. And like we had one girl in one game won $350 in the Buckeye board because the same score hit 3 times in one game. And I was like, holy shit, you imagine. So anyways, if you're interested, supporting a great cause and also having fun, it is a blast. I mean, I have people texting me like nonstop, like, damn it. Like, why'd they kick that field goal? I would have won $100 or $200. So it's fun. Anyways, we're doing that. This obviously the events we're doing, the tailgate this weekend, Michigan State, go get your tickets. It's going to be awesome. That obviously goes to Braxton's Foundation and our charity, which is the Earl and Jean Bruce Charitable Benefits. But I'm excited to announce and talk about this for a minute. We have created within my grandfather's charitable benefits charity, what we're calling the Zone 6 Fund, right? And this fund is going to be, here's my deal, right? We're giving all this money to Alzheimer's research. And, you know, when we raise money, we give it to certain places. And I want to have more diversity. I want to still give to Alzheimer's research, but I want to give to stuff also that I'm passionate about. And one is law enforcement. So we donated $1,500 to sponsor a law enforcement softball team just a couple weeks ago. And then I'm really excited about this Zone 6 Fund. So here's what we're going to do. I've always believed, and I know this for a fact, I mean, from Malik Harrison to, I mean, you name it, there's been City of Columbus kids that are extremely talented. Malik Harrison got recruited to Ohio State only because Luke Fickell thought he might have a chance, sent me to watch him play basketball, and I just fell in love with him and came back, and I was like, we need to scholarship this kid right now. But honestly, he was not a scholarship-level player on football tape. I watched him on mm-hmm. the basketball court and was like, this dude is a freak, right? And it pisses me off to an extent because it's like the City of Columbus, 1.5 million people in this city. You mean to tell me there's not, you know, 10 to 12 big time Division I football players in the city? Come on, man. That's a joke. The only reason there's not is they don't get coached. They don't get developed. And that's just the reality of it. So the Zone 6 Fund that I'm creating is going to do this. We're going to go case by case, player by player, and try to impact one life at a time. Right. And I'm going to do serious research into who we select. And it's got to be a kid with athletic potential, has to be getting it done in the classroom. or giving effort and needs resources in the classroom, right? And obviously needs to have the financial, not struggle, but they need it, right? You can't be some rich kid that is a good player and we're going to scholarship you. So we're going to scholarship them in the offseason to work at Plus Two University over in Worthington, because a guy named Eric Lichter, if you don't know him, him and Cardale Jones opened a gym long time. Well, he's the best performance and strength conditioning and speed coach I've ever been around, and that's saying a lot. He's ridiculous from analytics to sports science to he's brilliant. And so he opened a gym. He trained, I mean, back before he was a strength coach at Ohio State under Tressel. Before that, he was a private sector trainer. He trained LeBron James, Ted Ginn. I mean, NBA.
Who's who? Yeah, a who's who of elite athletes in the area.
If you're a Northeast Ohio elite player back in that era, you trained with Lichter. You just did. And Jim Tressel kind of shocked the world when he hired him to be the strength coach at Ohio State, because that usually isn't a crossover. Usually you're a college strength coach and work your way up, or you are a private sector guy and that's just what you do. So anyways, the best of the best. My son's going to start going there this winter. I actually go there and train receivers every now and then. So I'm going to scholarship, and we're talking about like $3,000, $4,000 value for a Columbus City school kid. And it doesn't have to be Columbus City. It just needs to be a kid that can't afford it, that has the potential and the drive and the character. So we're going to scholarship, you know, one kid at a time. And every $3,000 we raise, we're going to add another kid. And hopefully we get some success stories, a kid that you never know what would have happened, but they end up going to play big time college football because we were able to afford them those resources. Cause I go to Plus Two and it's a bunch of kids that have money, you know, some talented kids, but it's like, why not the city kid too? Why not the kid that doesn't have money? Not just city kid, but why not the kid that can't afford it if he wants to, has to. So I bring that up for two reasons. One, if you have a kid in mind, or you know of a kid, email me, Zach@Menace2Sports. I want to start researching and looking into kids, because we want to start this in January with as many kids as we can. That's first and foremost. Secondly, if you want to donate to that fund specifically, outside of obviously do the boards, the Buckeye boards, the for charity, or come to the event that supports it. But if you want to donate directly, reach out to me. I have to get the info on how to do that. But reach out to me, Zach@Menace2Sports.com, because I'm really excited about it, man. I'm excited. You know, I got into coaching because I wanted to change lives. Now I'm not in coaching, but I don't want to not do that anymore, right? I want to still impact kids. And so this is my way of doing it. So wanted to start the show off with that, just to kind of give you guys an insight into what we got going on and what I'm working on. And really got some huge, huge things coming the next, you know, 2 months. And I'm really excited about it. So thank you for supporting, even if it's just listening. Chris, enough about my soapbox and what I'm trying to do to change the world one kid at a time. It's Michigan State Week, man.
It is Michigan State Week. And this is kind of one of the, you know, to me, it was a rivalry. It's kind of since kind of backed off a little bit. But for a while there, when I was growing up, Michigan State was a better team than Michigan. So it got a lot more of my attention and played spoiler a lot more. So you were there, I believe. You got there in 2012, right?
2012 was, when Urban's first year. 2012 was my first year.
2012, that was the undefeated year. Bowl ban, obviously. You guys would have been in the national title against Notre Dame. How important was it for you guys to go undefeated regardless of that?
You know, it was one of those things. Nobody thought about it. No one. I mean, obviously, you're trying to win every game you play. I mean, that's just what you're trying to do. And we knew we weren't a very good football team. I mean, we had some talented kids that hadn't bought in. We weren't near as talented as we thought we should be. And we weren't near, you know, we didn't coach as well as we did 2 years later. I mean, we were skating on thin ice a lot that year, but you know what? That team had so much resiliency and resolve. They just found ways to pull out games that you shouldn't win. The overtime win against Purdue when Braxton goes out, like, shouldn't have won that game. What are we talking about? Odds. I mean, I think we had like a 6% chance of winning that game when we were down with like 50 seconds left on our own side of the field, down by 8. It was like, no way should you win that game. Yeah. Michigan State was another QB one.
Yeah.
I mean, we had game after we shouldn't have beat UAB. Miami of Ohio was a battle. I mean, it was like, it was just a perfect storm. And the crazy thing is if we were eligible for the postseason, we were not the best team in the country. Alabama was, but they had a loss and Notre Dame was undefeated, and we would have beat Notre Dame in the last, second to last BCS national championship. So we would have been national champions, and I promise you, probably one of the worst national champions in the history of the game.
But, so that first Michigan State game, you guys only won by 1 point, I believe.
Yeah, so let's just talk about Michigan State. So that was really the turning point in the season, right? That was our fifth game of the year, and mm-hmm. we had struggled against some bad football teams before that. We beat Cal on a busted coverage where they just forgot. I mean, the corner played cover two, the safety didn't, and Devin Smith was just wide open down the field. That's how we beat Cal. We barely beat UAB. I think we were losing at halftime. Miami of Ohio was a struggle. The kids hadn't really bought in, and something happened before Michigan State. It was a road game. They were pretty good. They were ranked at the time, and we went. It was a road game, and so it was really our first test away from home, and kids kind of. It was a battle. I mean, that was in early October. Yeah. So from the time we got hired in January, that was almost a 10-month battle between players and staff to try to change the culture. And that was the moment that Urban talks about all the time, championship water, where he just stood up before the game and was like, I'm asking you right now, fuck it all. Eliminate everything that's ever happened. I'm asking you to rip your chest open and give us your heart. If you give us your heart and buy into what we're trying to do, magical things will happen. And for whatever reason, that day, that game, that environment, those kids decided to buy in. And I'll never forget. And I don't want to take credit for it. You know what? I won't take credit for it because it was really Mike Vrabel. But I think a part of it was before we went out on the field, Mike Vrabel and I started like almost a mosh pit in the locker room. Mike Vrabel shattered like a couple lights. Like I was breaking lockers. We destroyed. I think they had to pay because of the damage to the
damn locker room.
But those kids just fucking, it was over. Like they had a different, and Andrew Norwell, that's when he was born. Those of you that don't know Andrew Norwell, he played guard still starting in the NFL years mm-hmm. later. I mean, what an unbelievable career for the Jaguars back with Urban. But he was they called him the water buffalo. He would put water in his mouth and spray it everywhere. He had long hair, just crazy. And he had this insane look in his eyes, started breaking shit. Like they broke, those like ceilings, like breaking ceiling tiles. It was nuts.
And you
saw a team go out and it was like, all right, it's time to go. And the whole season, the whole culture, the whole program changed that day.
And that was such a hard fought win. Like that was such a hard fought win.
Honestly, it was down 13-10 late in the third quarter. And the difference maker was Devin Smith. That's when he was born. That's when he came alive. He was going against a first round corner in Johnny Adams, another Akron kid, right? Devin and Johnny Adams were both Akron kids. And it was a battle. Johnny Adams ended up being a first rounder, was a great player. And Devin got his ass in the late third quarter. He snatched him. The kid kind of tripped, fell down. Devin kind of snagged him down and went 63 yards for the game-winning touchdown. And that's when Devin Smith started to come alive. And, the rest is history where Devin's career went after that. But it was really the starting point of not only the program, not only Urban's tenure, not only the starting point, but to the national championship. But Michigan State had probably more of an impact on Ohio State's program in the last, 9 years than any opponent has, right? You look at what I'm telling you right now from a first-hander's experience, that 2012 game road trip changed the trajectory of the program, changed the culture, right? 2013, obviously the next year
was the championship game.
Didn't play them in the regular season and they beat us. We're now 24-0 and getting ready to go to the BCS national title game, the one we should have been in the year before. And they beat us in the Big Ten championship game and kind of exposed the flaws in us offensively in my mm-hmm. group, specifically the receivers, and our defense was pathetic in 2013. And because of that game, we changed our entire defense. My group, I changed how I taught them entirely in man coverage, especially against quarters, changed everything I did. And then 2014, look what happens, right?
2014, your boys were rolling, dude.
Not only that, not only in that game, but we're talking about the season now.
Mm-hmm. I mean, all season, no, those boys were rolling all season.
And defensively, we bring in Chris Ash. He's a quarters guy, but he's not a press quarters Michigan State defense guy. Not that he doesn't know it, but that wasn't his MO. But Urban demanded. He said, this is the hardest defense I've ever went up against. We're running it. And we did. We put in that defense, had our own wrinkle to it, and ended up winning a national championship because of it. And mm-hmm. and we went out, and that was a game where I'm telling you, like, I've never been more proud of my group. People ask all the time, what was your favorite game as a coach? It's always the answer, the 2014 Michigan State game, because of how they exposed us the year before, because my group struggled in 2013, and because that was really the emergence of my group helping lead the way You know, with Zeke and with the run game, but my group was ridiculous from that game on.
There was that third and 24, right? That third and 24 that Devin Smith caught.
Unbelievable. The slant Michael Thomas took 70 some yards for a touchdown.
Did you think he was going to get caught? Did you think he was going to get caught from behind or no?
Everyone did. I mean, he threw his head back and was running like a fat kid.
He was rumbling. I think Jerron Gates has better running form than Michael Thomas, man.
I'm telling you.
He was running in slow motion.
But that's also the game I always point to when people say JT couldn't throw. I mean, that was his last year with a real quarterback coach. I take that back. When Ryan Day came in, he tried to fix everything. But JT was too ridiculous gone, that game. Yeah. 16 to 26, 300 yards, three touchdowns. He dropped that dime on third down that you're talking about to Devin Smith over his outside shoulder. And my group, I've never had a more prepared group because they were so pissed about losing the year before that they just wanted it. I mean, they wanted it so bad. Mike had almost 100 yards. Devin had 130 yards. Devin had the one touchdown. Mike had one touchdown. Dontre Wilson had a touchdown in the red zone with a broken foot. And you talk one of my proudest moments, not proudest moments, but one something that I've bragged about at times and just kind of how locked in I was as a position coach. Dontre breaks his foot, right? Which is right foot that he breaks. So we're in the red zone. Jalen Marshall is blown out, exhausted. He needs to come out. I got to either put in a young kid or I'm looking at Dontre with a broken foot. Now, we didn't know it was broken, but he didn't play after he hurt it. And I'm looking, all right, and I know the play call we're going to call, right? And so Dontre's going to line up on the right side of the field, and he has a corner route, and it's only time you throw it to him is if it's an all-out blitz. Well, it's third down in the red zone, and I just know Pat Narduzzi's about to just light us up, right? So I sub Dontre in because he's on the right side of the field and he's going to have to plant with his left foot, his good foot, on the corner route, right? And I knew it was going to be a zero pressure. I couldn't afford to have a young kid in and him not make the play. So I sub Dontre in. This is in split seconds. I think about all this and put him in. And he puts his foot in the ground, makes the play in what is like the game-sealing touchdown. And it was like, wow. Like the inches to win.
I remember, I remember crying in my bed watching that play. That's absurd. Yep. I didn't.
You talk about another impact. All right. In that game, Evan Spencer had one carry for 9 yards because we ran the trick play that eventually we would run against Alabama.
And he didn't
throw to Mike Thomas for a touchdown. And Mike was wide open, but Evan didn't trust it. So his coaching point was, if it's not there, take off and run, right? That's what I taught him to do on the reverse pass. Well, in that game, he didn't throw it. He took off and run, got 9 yards. And the entire film session, my entire group was just killing him. Like, because Evan was a cocky guy throwing the ball. And they're like, bro, oh, okay, Peyton Manning, like you think you're Tom Brady. Like, that's not open enough for you. Like, talking shit, mad shit, right? And then you fast forward to the Alabama game. There's no way Evan throws that ball to Mike in the Alabama game if he throws it in Michigan State or if those players don't give him so much shit for not throwing it the first time. So just the history of college, the history of Ohio State, I mean, the last decade, there's so much that comes from this rivalry game, this Michigan State game. So much.
Dog, that's so insane because you're right. I remember hearing a clip from Evan Spencer after they won the national title about him saying, yeah, I was throwing that no matter what, like no matter what I was throwing it in. And it's kind of like, oh, like, I don't know. Like that was definitely ill-advised, but you're right. I mean, that's some crazy ass
ill-advised. I told his ass right before he went on the field. I was like, this is at the end of the half. We at least want a field goal, right? We need points. I said, if it's not there, throw it in the stands. Like, don't mess with this. We need points. And he's like, I got you.
Sure it wasn't enough, there.
It's not there, and some bitch drops the dime. Probably the best pass in the history of Ohio State.
Yeah, that's the best show in Ohio State history.
So that was 2014, and then 2015, we all know, it's the most asked about game that I have to answer was the rainstorm. Don't hand it to Zeke. Don't throw it to Michael Thomas. Just run JT 15 times for 44 yards and lose 17-14 on a last second field goal because JT honestly couldn't throw. I mean, that's what it was. We couldn't run the ball because they were loading the box, so you need to throw it. JT couldn't throw because of the rain and because he wasn't a great passer to begin with. And it was a nightmare, a train wreck. We should have handed it to Zeke because, I mean, if you're going to have an extra defender, you'd rather have Zeke carrying the ball than JT. But just a nightmare. And obviously, that was probably
the last time we lost to them.
Yeah, last time we lost. And then, you know, fast forward to 2016, a close win, 17-16, mostly. And the other thing that happened after 2014, now you're going to see outside of that. I mean, that was very situational how we lost in 2015.
Yeah.
I mean, we couldn't run the ball. We had an awful offensive staff, offensive play caller, and JT couldn't throw it that day because it was like freezing rain. But Pat Narduzzi left in 2014, and Michigan State's never been the same. I mean, now they're bounced back, obviously, but the rest of my time, they were never the same. I mean, 2016, we won by 1 point only because our offensive coordinator was pathetic, right? And then it just, the wheels came off. Once Ed Warner was gone, Ryan Day and Kevin Wilson come in, and then you're winning 48-3 in 2017, 26-6 in 2018, 34-10 in 2019, and then last year, Larry Johnson leads the Buckeyes to a 52-12 win over Michigan State at Michigan State. But this is a different beast coming to town, and obviously I'm going to break it down on my show later today, or I'm sorry, later this week. But it's so crazy to think about how this rivalry, it is a pseudo rivalry. I mean, Ohio State, mm-hmm. obviously nothing will rival the Michigan rivalry, but Michigan State and Penn State have had their moments that have really made this into kind of a little brother rivalry, you know?
Yeah, well, for people my age, especially, I'm 24. The last time I saw Michigan beat Ohio State was, you know, the Luke Fickell year, and that was kind of the one-off year. Other than that, I've never seen it. And so I've seen Michigan State beat Ohio State. I've seen Penn State beat Ohio State and, like, been really invested and really hurt by it. And because I don't have that same hurt with Michigan, for me, these games are absolutely rivalry games that I kind of want to see Ohio State step on the throat of these teams and keep it going. Now, I know, obviously, like, Michigan's, like, the number one rival, but this definitely is a pseudo-rivalry because of the fact that these teams have beaten Ohio State more recently and quite honestly more frequently.
Oh, there's no doubt. There's no doubt. And it will never surpass the Michigan game as a rivalry because of the emphasis placed and because of the history. And that's just in the veins of Ohio State players. And now I think it's in the veins of Michigan players, at least temporarily this year. Mm-hmm. But it's just going to be, it's going to be interesting to see how this game plays out. I mean, I'm excited to watch the game for a number of reasons. One, Michigan State's pass defense is absolutely horrendous. We saw this against Purdue. So CJ Stroud should have a freaking day. Those receivers should absolutely go off. But it'd be interesting to see. I mean, I think this kid's the running back, Kenneth Walker III. I think he's the best player in college football because they don't have an intermediate pass game. They don't have much play action. Honestly, all they do is launch it down the field and hand the ball to him. And they throw a quick game, like little short routes. So it'll be a test for Ohio State. I think it's going to be interesting to see how they test Ohio State down the field. And it's going to be a game. I don't think it's going to be a blowout like people might think. But it's one of those games that it could, though, because their pass defense is just so bad.
So bad. Now, this will be the first kind of staple mark in CJ Stroud getting a Heisman moment and potentially win the Heisman. I'm going to say it right now, Zach. CJ Stroud is going to win the Heisman if they win these next three games, like despite what Bryce Young does. And this will be the first mark of him being able to get a Heisman moment. It is a top 10 matchup. You know, it's funny because he's probably going to win. I think he's going to win the Heisman, but I also think he's like the fifth best player on offense for this team.
And not to take anything away from him, if he does, I mean, unbelievable, but that is true. I mean, honestly, it's probably the worst year, or not, you don't want to say the worst, but there is far more deserving quarterbacks over the last 10 years that did not win the Heisman. Braxton Miller, my God, he's, I mean, twice the player that CJ Stroud was or is right now. Not is going to be. I don't want this to be a shit on CJ Stroud segment, but Braxton Miller was a far more deserving Heisman Trophy winner than CJ Stroud. JT Barrett, even, you could make a case, didn't throw it like CJ Stroud, but was a more valuable player overall, probably. And then Dwayne Haskins and Justin Fields were, they were a better version of Stroud. It's just whatever. If it happened,
Deshaun Watson didn't win a Heisman.
Right. Like, you don't have a negative connotation about a kid winning the Heisman, but you're like, what? Right. Like, of all the quarterbacks we've watched the last 10 years, this is the one I can't imagine. I don't think he will. I mean, I honestly don't think he will. I think Kenneth Walker III does. The problem he's going to have is if they don't beat Ohio State, then he has two losses and it just doesn't look good. And the Heisman cares about your record for some reason. But
No, Zach, I'm calling it right now. CJ Stroud is going to win the Heisman.
Well,
it's just lined up too perfectly for him at this point. He's now the Vegas favorite. Yeah, you're right. Which I do have my concerns about his mental state going into that, because I don't think he's a warrior, first of all, and second of all, unlike Dwayne Haskins, he's obviously not like a longtime Ohio State fan, and doesn't dream of that moment. So we'll see. But I think it is lining up. If he loses the Heisman, it's going to be solely on him. because I think it is his for the taking at this moment. But like I said, fourth best, fifth best player on that offense. Something else I wanted to, that you texted me this morning. The power of recruiting.
Yeah. How about this? So Fuente is out at Virginia Tech. He just got fired on what, November 15th or whatever it was, last night or this morning. They just announced it this morning. And it's crazy because we're literally 30 days away. So he got fired and his buyout is $10 million. So they have to pay him $10 million to fire him, first of all. Fucking nuts, right?
That's insane.
Insane. And so that's one insane. But the craziest part is, if they had waited till December 15th, that would have dropped from 10 million to 7.5 million. So they literally paid an extra 2.5 million to fire him today, as opposed to 4 weeks from now. And the reason is, or the early signing period, right? They don't want to wait till December 15th. And I don't know the exact day that it is, the signing day, but they don't want to wait until December 15th and lose this class entirely, then fire the guy, bring in a new coach. And now that new coach is fucked. I mean, he's set up for failure without a class this year. You want to, at least you look at classes in transition, and there's always, I look at our 2012 class, like there's only going to be a handful, maybe 3, 4, 5 guys that are a part of the rebuild if it works, right? Mm-hmm. It's just the reality of what happens, right? You're scrambling. You try to find a bunch of dudes that hopefully, you know, you're trying to fill your roster. You're trying to fill spots. You need bodies. And how many of those with that little time can actually like play, come in and play right away? Like, you look at our class in 2012, right? Let's just go through it. This is with what we got hired early December. So this is before signing period. So you had like 2 months to recruit him. Noah Spence, obviously great player, drug issues, ended up having to, the NCAA kicked him out basically, but great player. Adolphus Washington played a ton. Tommy Shutt didn't really play. Savion Pittman didn't play. Briante Dunn didn't play. A lot of issues. Armani Reeves played a little bit. Joshua Perry was a crown jewel in that class, right? Right now, mm-hmm. You can say Adolphus Washington and Joshua Perry were great. Great takes, right?
And yeah,
Taylor Decker was a third.
Yeah, and Taylor, yeah.
Taylor Decker was a third. Then Cameron Williams never really – he played a little bit. He was very, very valuable, but wasn't a great player. David Perkins, I mean, the only thing he ever did at Columbus was hit Brutus in that one spring practice that went viral. Devin Bogard, rest in peace, man. He had an unbelievable off-the-field impact but had a bunch of injuries. Warren Ball didn't play. Kyle Dotson didn't play. Joey O'Connor, I mean, I think he was there for like a day and a half. Jamal Marcus didn't play. Najee Murray didn't play. Frank Epitropoulos didn't play. Tyvus Powell's another one, a really big impact player.
Yeah, I've never heard Southward, of half these kids.
Yeah, Raquan Southward was a receiver that was committed when I got here, and he transferred after like a week. Blake Thomas was like a fullback. He didn't really play. He was a tight end. He didn't play at all. Jacoby Boren was a guy that you say, all right, wow, that was a guy that developed and came on and was a key piece for the national championship game. Then obviously Cardale Jones, Michael Thomas. So mm-hmm. Pat Elflein, and then Luke Roberts didn't play at all. So you're looking Pat Elflein, one, Mike Thomas, Cardale Jones, Jacoby Boren. That's four. I think Tyvus Powell's five.
Yeah. Crazy, Zach. A lot of guys that played, these guys were like outside the top 300. Like, I'm looking at it. Pat Elflein was hardly number 1,000. Obviously Tyvus Powell was close to 500. The only players that were in the top 100 were Noah Spence and Adolphus Washington. Other than that, I mean, the guys that played and contributed were all outside of that top 100.
Yeah, and you look at it, that first class, I mean, and that was an insanely successful transition class, right? 25 mm-hmm. enrollees, 9 of them were really good players, right? Under half, but 9 of 25 were really good players. Noah Spence obviously had his issue that why he wasn't. I mean, we'd had Noah Spence and Joey Bosa in the national championship year as our defensive ends, which is insane. But he was gone, obviously. But 9 of 25, that's the best you can do. And just think about what the program would have been in 2014 if we didn't have those 8 players, right?
Yeah.
It would have, and that's what Virginia Tech is doing right now. They're saying $2.5 million is worth it for 8 players, right? That's literally what they're saying. Because you're probably at best, and at Virginia Tech, it's probably more like 6, right? Crazy. Mm-hmm. Crazy. So you're talking about, they basically are valuing each contributing player in this class at $416,000 of value. Like that's what they just said, right? If they have 6 players in this class in 2 years be heavy contributors, they are paying this guy $420,000 per kid to get him out the door so a new coach can come in and try to find six kids that can be a part of the change, right?
When you put it like that, that's absolutely absurd. And then they in the ACC, maybe that's like you need those six kids to kind of change things because the ACC is so down.
They got to go recruit 25 kids and hope six of them are contributors 2 years later. That's what they need. Mm-hmm. And then the following year, it needs to be a complete roster overhaul, just like we watched Michigan State do. That's what it has to be. That's the formula for flipping a program. People are asking me about already who's a good fit there. And I saw my guy, Uncle Silk, shout out to the Big Three roll up down in Florida, or the Big Three Network now. I saw he tweeted, and it's so true. Like, stop talking about who Virginia Tech should get, because the reality is, LSU's got to find their guy first, right? USC's got to find their guy first. Virginia Tech's got to sit. I mean, you know.
And maybe Florida's got to get their guy next, too. Now, I think Dan Mullen used his get-out-of-jail-free card, but there are better jobs. There are better jobs.
A ton better. Now, you're just going to look for a system fit, right? Mm-hmm. And the real question is, and honestly, where I think they might look is Shane Beamer. I mean, Frank Beamer's son, he wants no part of the SEC. You see it in his interviews. I mean, he's at South Carolina getting his dick knocked in. And outside of Florida, who's he kicked in? I don't think he wants to bite off that SEC week in, week out at South Carolina. I don't know that anybody can do a better job than Lou Holtz and then Steve Spurrier did. And you're talking about two Hall of Fame coaches, and they were marginally successful. It's just a tough job. I don't think it's a great job. I could see him jumping to Virginia Tech. In that case, they don't have to wait, right?
And that's a legacy fit. And that I mean, obviously,
it fits on so many levels. Mm-hmm. So I could see that happening. I'm not sure that they would be too thrilled about it. I think Shane Beamer is a good coach. I don't think he's his dad. I don't think he's, you know, going to be a big time. I don't know if he's better than Fuente, to be honest with you. But so that happened, and we got some job openings now. They're talking about you texted me Tom Herman to Washington is a possibility.
Yeah, that is the rumored situation right now. Tom Herman to UW, which I know more about Tom Herman than I do. But the text message you sent back was he might not be too bad there because the Pac-12 is just absolutely awful.
Well, Tom Herman has an interesting. I will tell you this. He has an interesting, I guess, life story where almost everywhere he's been, he can claim to be from there, right? Because he was born in Ohio, down in Cincinnati, right? He did. He was raised in Southern California, and then he went to college in Texas, I believe. And his first couple jobs were in Texas. So he was in Texas for a long time. So he finds a way. He's like a chameleon. Like when he was in Ohio, he's an Ohio guy, right? He's an Ohio State, an Ohio guy, born and bred. Then he goes to Houston in Texas, and he's like, I've been a Texas guy my whole life. And now if he goes to the West Coast, he's like born and raised in Southern California. Like he has the perfect three storylines. The only place he can't go is the Southeast because it's like, yeah, I don't know anything about this place. Other than he knows Tootsie's in Miami better than anybody. But I do think it's a decent fit. I've said forever, Tom Herman is a really good football coach. His program is a facade because he's a facade. He's a fake human being. He has low morals and just lives an absolute facade. It's a fake life, right? Beautiful wife, beautiful kids. I mean, not a good husband, not a good family man. I think he's a good dad. I'm not knocking him as a dad. His kids are awesome, but you know, everything's a phony, right? He gets drunk, hits on boosters' wives, like all this shit. And it's like, all right, well, would that be a fit out on the West Coast? Like, one, could he temper his ass down? Maybe he's humbled by getting fired. He's a brilliant football mind. If he can kind of, I don't know, change who he is, Steve Sarkisian style, maybe he could be successful there. And I don't think it's a bad hire for Washington. I really don't. I actually think it's a good fit.
Would you worry about him coaching at a place with academic prowess like that? That kind of is really.
I really don't. I mean, one, I've said it before. He's a card carrying Mensa. Like, he's brilliant. And he also coached at Rice, which is an unbelievable academic institution. Like, he's very smart. He can coach smart kids. He can recruit smart kids. This is not he could be the coach at Stanford, Vanderbilt. Absolutely. Yeah. He could fit that mold. He's brilliant. He's a brilliant human being. He really is.
Yeah, I was just thinking about like recruiting wise because I know that there are some limitations with who they can take at Washington.
I don't know, and I don't know the academic prowess of some of the great players Washington's had, but I think Washington likes football too, right? I think they're more like Michigan or Ohio State than you would think. Where, they're elite academically, but you know what? They're going to, as long as we always said at Ohio State, can a kid survive here, right? Because there are some kids that academically or IQ wise, they, no matter what you do, you could give them 100 tutoring hours. They could work really hard. They're not going to be able to succeed in a classroom where the average ACT is 33. Like, they're not. And then there's some kids that maybe they just have that work ethic, and they have the cognitive ability to, if they work hard enough and will work, they can make it, right? And so it's about finding the right kids. But I absolutely think he could thrive there.
All right. Well, look, you spoke on it. There it is. Two quick things before we wrap things up, Zach. Does the Biletnikoff Award need a new voting structure? Should voters lose their, you know, get stripped by that? Because the top 10 list came out and it does not have Garrett Wilson or Jackson Smith and Njigba on it.
I mean, every award, these awards are, I mean, they're media clickbait awards. Who votes on them? That's what you need to ask yourself. Who is a Biletnikoff voter? It's media members. Mm-hmm. Like, what does I'm not saying there are certainly media members who are credible and might have the background to tell you who the best receivers are in the country. But why the fact that I'm not on the list is all you need to know. There's nobody on that list that can evaluate receivers better than me. I promise you that.
I've seen some voters and it's like, oh my goodness. It's like, who's like Little Jimmy from the Little Jimmy Sports Network voting on receivers. And it's like, absurd. Oh my goodness, it's gracious. Absurd.
And, you know, most of the time it's always stat chasers. That's why Oklahoma State will have a guy in there mm-hmm. that has 2000 yards because they throw it to him every play. Penn State, you know, has had multiple receivers where they I can't remember who the receiver was. It was a kid from Virginia. I forget his name. They had a receiver that we were up by 21 points in the fourth quarter and they should just be running the clock down and they are throwing to this kid every single play. And you're like, the only reason they're doing it is so it could say against Ohio State, he had 16 catches for 130 yards. And you're like, this is just, it's fake. And that kid was first team All Big Ten and Michael Thomas wasn't. And you're like, what the fuck is wrong with people? Like, no, it needs to change. It never will. And that's why this year we're gonna give out Menace Awards. And I'm going to tell you who the real fucking first best receiver in the country was. And we might even, you know what? I need to check my finances. I might buy trophies and send it to these motherfuckers and be like, listen, you're the GOAT. And it might just
Let's
be a GOAT.
Go.
It might right, be a just... bronze GOAT. Because it's absurd. And I'm going to make a Heisman, too. I'm going to make a Heisman with, like, maybe a crying face Michael Jordan on it. And I'm going to send that to the best player in the country. Because it's just ridiculous how these awards are voted on and kids are remembered and they get trees and plaques and all this shit. It's like, yeah, this fucking guy named Steve McClain at Florida or Jerry Emig at Ohio State thought you were the best receiver in the country. Like, congratulations. Like, what the fuck do they know about receivers?
Yeah, that's what kind of caught me off guard a little bit because Chris Olave is third on the team in catches and receiving yards. And well, yet he was the thing, only.
Right? Is he the most deserving from Ohio State? I don't think they're going to have more than one guy from a school on the list anyways, but you'd like them to just evaluate. And I'm not even saying he's not the best receiver. I would have mm-hmm. put Garrett Wilson slightly above him. I think Jackson Smith and Jigba is a product of one being in the slot and getting mismatches and two having those kids outside with so much attention on them.
Exactly.
So I'm not here to say he is certainly third of three, but I probably would have given Garrett a slight edge. And the only reason I promise you they put Olave in over Garrett is Garrett is a year younger technically, right? He's mm-hmm. a class younger. So it's like, oh, you know, give it to the senior, right? This kid's had 4 years of exceptional success. Let's put him in.
Yeah, I just thought it should have been a Jamar Chase and Justin Jefferson thing where they both made the list. But you know, that's why I don't get the big bucks though. Closing thoughts, Zach, do you have a prediction for the college football playoff top four today?
I think it's going to be the same four. I mean, I think it's going to be Georgia 1, Alabama 2, Oregon 3, Ohio State 4. And then, you know, after that, who knows? Cincinnati probably 5 maybe. And then it will be in the Michigan State realm. So we'll see.
I'm going to call my shot. I think that Ohio State leaps up to number 2.
You think they make the switch? They're going to make the switch eventually.
Yeah, I think they make the switch all the way up to number 2 because of what happened with Texas A&M.
Yeah, I honestly think that they'll wait until Ohio State beats Michigan State and Michigan, then they'll jump them to 3 before the Big Ten championship game, just because, you know, I know they beat Purdue, and I know mm-hmm. I know their resume now, but Michigan State, a one-loss Michigan State team, back-to-back with a one-loss Michigan team, I think if they can win those two games, they're going to jump Oregon for sure. I think they'll wait to do that to then, but they're going to do it eventually, obviously, unless Ohio State loses. So I think it's unfazed, unchanged this week, and they keep rolling and let the games play out and try to find a way to put Notre Dame back in to get them embarrassed.
Love to hear it. All right, Zach, that's all I got for today.
Appreciate it, man. Menace out.
Menace out.